When I say the phrase iconic photograph, what kinds of images come to mind for you? It could be any one of a large catalogue which we've collectively immortalised in modern history, from Neil Armstrong on the moon, a single man standing in front of a line of tanks near Tiananmen Square, the Black Power salute at the 1968 Olympics, the Hindenburg exploding, whatever it may be in this space. All of these images are not only stark and memorable in terms of their quality as a photograph, but also the meaning that they contain. Whether it is industrial era hubris, civil rights, our exploratory human nature. You might even have your own versions of your iconic photographs, the ones you are most likely to share or keep in a safe place. Photos of family, of places, of special events. All of these share this quality of meaning rather than simple aesthetics. Well, I'm going to begin this episode, well, what will end up being a multi-part exploration of the beginnings of the Vietnam War, on the 11th of June, 1963. A date which, well, the date does not live in infamy, but the photograph which was taken on that date certainly does. In the capital of South Vietnam, Saigon, in the southern district of the city, not far from the Cambodian embassy in fact, a procession of around 350 Buddhist monks and nuns began walking from a nearby pagoda to the intersection of Phan Dinh Phung Boulevard and Le Van Duet Street. They were chanting something that would more often be heard at funeral services. Upon arriving at the intersection, they formed a circle, a wall of people, into which a light blue British sedan drove up and parked within. Two young monks in their bright orange robes emerged from the car, and so did an older one named Quang Duc. June is the hottest month in Saigon, and if you've visited, well, many parts of Asia, you might be able to easily imagine the feeling of being on this kind of inner city street. The heat, even though it was only around 8 o'clock in the morning, the sounds, the familiar smell, in this case almost overwhelmingly punctuated by the wafting aroma of incense that the monks and nuns were burning. Now it's important to realize that what happens next is certainly not occurring within a vacuum. South Vietnam could be considered to be in the midst of several crises, and this particular event could be viewed as the climax of one of them, or within a tableau of all of them. This particular iteration on that theme was the so-called Buddhist crisis, and I will explain its origins amongst the rest of the turmoil that this new country was facing in due course. But what happened in the middle of this intersection in downtown Saigon, within this orange perimeter of chanting monks and nuns, touches upon one of the most important underlying themes of this series: how a person or person's actions can be so profoundly influenced by the energy produced via the ideas which we cultivate. We have spoken of many of them so far, whether it be religious, nationalistic, or political, or some combination thereof, when we will ask ourselves, why did they kill? Or, how could that happen? Or, why didn't they do that? We must attempt to address the ideas that motivate these actions or inactions. And when it comes to mass murder, these motivations can require extensive explanation. That's what this series is all about. But in this case, on this intersection in Saigon in 1963, we must ask ourselves why someone would volunteer to do something to themselves in order to expend this kind of energy. In any case, what occurred on the 11th of June in this crowd of monks and nuns was also being witnessed by a US photojournalist by the name of Malcolm Brown. There had actually been a general vibe for weeks now that something was going to happen, and that the Buddhists in the city were going to be at the heart of it. In fact, this US correspondent had received a phone call the night before, at 9 o'clock, by a monk who said that Mr. Brown I strongly advise you to come. I expect something very important will happen, but I cannot tell you what. Many of you listening are no doubt aware of what is going to happen. And for those who aren't, I hope it does not affect you to hear. But Mr. Brown, the photojournalist, had been invited for a very specific purpose. In fact, it was essential that he came. Without him or some other Western journalist there, the political statement that was going to be made would be rendered impotent. This ceremony, which had gradually been producing louder and louder chanting since it had begun a few blocks away, was reaching a fever pitch. The chanting abruptly ended at 9 a.m. Quang Duc, the elder monk in his mid-60s, exited this light blue British-made car and promptly sat in the traditional lotus-style position in the middle of the intersection. The two younger monks that had been in the car with him brought a plastic jerry can out, which was filled with aviation fuel, an important difference as it burns more slowly than petrol. It was 9:17 a.m. Quang Duc, meditating with his head slightly bowed, prayer beads on one hand, was then doused in the fuel by the monks that had accompanied him in the car. At 9:22, serenely sat, with a dignified expression, Quang Duc struck a match and touched it to his fuel-soaked lap. He was instantly engulfed in flames. A horrified look spread amongst the gathered crowd. Some wailed out in shock, others bowed down in front of the burning monk. But Quang Duc didn't utter a sound. He did not move as the black, oily smoke rose from the flames surrounding him. I came upon an article by a firefighter who described what a burning human body smells like, a profession where that is not an out-of-the-ordinary experience, sadly. Here is what he said, quote, "The smell of a burning body is the combination of burning skin, muscle, fat, hair, organs, spinal fluid, bacteria, and even possibly bone. That means there's a very complex smell to burning bodies, but it is one that is completely unmistakable, and once you smell it, you won't forget it. The smell of burning blood has a kind of coppery tinge to the aroma." End quote. I suppose those that were present on this intersection on that day will have never forgot the smell, amongst the incense and the plasticky smell of the fire's accelerant. Aside from the smoke, the heat, the smell, this horrific scene was also punctuated by the sounds of a megaphone operated by another of the monks present, stating in Vietnamese and English, "A Buddhist priest burns himself to death. A Buddhist priest becomes a martyr," over and over again. It is unclear exactly how long it took for Quang Duc to die, but it doesn't seem to have been very quickly. It was a full 13 minutes before his still burning body rocked backward onto the road from its lotus position. More than half an hour later, his charred corpse was attempted to be placed in a wooden coffin amongst prayers from his religious peers. Malcolm Brown had already sent his Vietnamese assistant back to their office in order to send the reels of photos he had taken across the globe. The immortal photo that was eventually shared on the front page of Associated Press newspapers would have a profound effect. Dubbed the Burning Monk, the photographs of the self-immolation of Quang Duc were not a spontaneous, unscripted event. Brown himself later remarked that, quote, "It was clearly theatre staged by the Buddhists to achieve a certain political end. At the same time, there was a human element to it that was just horrifying, because the sequence of pictures showed the initial shock of the flames touching his face, and so forth. Because that was the whole point, to produce theatre of the horrible so striking that the reasons for the demonstrations would become apparent to everyone." End quote. It's kind of interesting that this photo is often, vaguely remembered as a kind of anti-war photo, that the monk was protesting the Vietnam War generally and the US presence in Vietnam. But this isn't exactly the case, most notably because it is kind of hard to make the case that the Vietnam War, as we generally think of it, is occurring in mid-1963. It was still in the phase of having a relatively small amount of American advisors on the ground, as opposed to legions of combatants, although that is certainly on the horizon. No, what it is more apparent that Quang Duc was protesting, and what several others did in a similar fashion afterwards, was really about the Diem regime. And as I said, this so-called Buddhist crisis was set amongst a range of other difficulties the regime was having. In essence, this horrific sacrifice was a kind of nationalistic protest against the government's position on Buddhism generally in South Vietnam, and had been sparked by the army killing demonstrators, Buddhist demonstrators, who had fears about the role that Buddhism was going to play in Diem's nation. Quang Duc's own words, the last words he wrote before his self-immolation, reflect this. Quote, "Before closing my eyes and moving towards the vision of the Buddha, I respectfully plead to President Ngo Dinh Diem to take a mind of compassion towards the people of the nation and implement religious equality to maintain the strength of the homeland eternally. I call the venerables, reverends, members of the Sangha, and the lay Buddhists to organize in solidarity to make sacrifices to protect Buddhism." End quote. Within a Vietnamese context, this protest was extremely profound. It showed just how poorly the Diem regime was doing in the South. Within a Western view, it could be seen as a deeply concerning indication that the US was propping up a regime that was so riddled with problems that its own people would go to such extreme lengths to show these problems to the world. But the protest itself was not against the Vietnam War, generally speaking, even though in our collective consciousness, we tend to place the photo of the protest on par with the other immortal photo from this region and era, that of a 9-year-old girl burning, running down a street, having been hit in a napalm attack in 1973. But for this story, particularly for this episode, what Quang Duc's self-immolation gives us as a means of exploring the two Vietnams in the early 1960s is that things were not going well for the government that the US hoped would provide a bulwark against further communist expansion in the region. The burning monk photo may be one of the most clear signs of the end of the Diem regime, and a possible early catalyst for those in the US who began questioning just what the heck they are doing there. A sentiment that will eventually coalesce into the anti-Vietnam War movement. We will revisit the events of Quang Duc's death and its aftermath, amongst many other events that had led to this horrible state of affairs over the course of the next two episodes. But in this first part of this little mini-series, we will explore the development of two separate Vietnams and the path that will lead to the Second Indochina War. Alright everyone, welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia. If you're listening to this around the time it has been released, I do apologise for the delay. Life can sometimes get in the way of this thing, but I'm always glad to get to this point again where I can get an episode out for you. I'll take this time as well to say again, thank you so much to everyone who supports the show on Patreon or has donated via PayPal. It means a great deal to me. if you do have the time as well, I absolutely love reading every single review that comes in on whatever platform you may be listening to this on. So that's a great help as well if you are using particularly Apple Podcasts or any service that has a review or rating function. Go ahead and pop one on there, and like I said, I keep an eye on that space and I love reading them. Now, in the last episode, I wanted to just tie up a few loose ends from the Cambodian side of the story into the early 1960s, but with some of the other tangents that the show has necessarily gone down in the previous few releases, it has become important that we return to the, what we call it, the real dynamo of this historical hurricane, which is the bisected states of Vietnam. I think, sort of generally speaking, we've only vaguely touched on what has been happening in North and South Vietnam since that division itself occurred at the end of the Geneva Accords in 1954. So that's what we need to do. To just give you a little peek behind the curtain here, I had originally envisioned this episode to cover, well, all of the developments into the fateful year of 1963 that I began the episode with, but it was too much. We have to talk about how these states develop, the role of the US, Lao, the establishment of the National Liberation Front, the Viet Cong, the crises of 1963, assassinations, the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's a lot. And what I hope will be something that you, my dear listener, will appreciate is a slightly less long episode with a tighter focus, and hopefully a quicker turnaround too. So part one, this one, will be explaining the two Vietnams, generally, up until the early 1960s. Part two will be about US involvement in the region, the Lao crisis, and a growing insurgency in the South that will essentially be the start of the Second Indochina War. Now, part three will be more concerned with the second half of 1963. We'll touch on, you know, assassinations, how the insurgency that we will characterize the early part of the Vietnam War looks. It's a lot, like I said. So probably three smaller episodes and hopefully coming out much quicker as well. But with all that boring stuff out of the way, I'm glad to be back. Glad to have you here listening to me, and let's talk about North Vietnam. It was all the way back on episode 14 that we discussed the end of the First Indochina War, and I remember briefly discussing the aftermath of the Geneva Accords in relation to Vietnam. Now, if you'll recall, the country we now call Vietnam had become a kind of leopard print of different areas in which either the French or the Viet Minh had called their own. Owing to the nature of the competition between the two for control of the whole country, Ho Chi Minh had declared the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and begun the processes necessary to have a functioning state, except it was scattered across the predominantly rural areas of the country. And once the Geneva Accords had divided the country across the 17th parallel, with the entirety of the North becoming theirs, the mission to consolidate that area under their control began in earnest. So what does that mean? Well, essentially, the processes that had already begun during the later stages of the war with the French were now carried out across the country they now completely possessed. While nationalism and anti-colonialism were the first and foremost ideological banners, naturally, so too was communism. Next to Ho Chi Minh's portrait hung similarly glowing depictions of Marx, Lenin, Stalin, and Mao. Communism was the new state religion, and class was the operating framework to define social and political identity. As Christopher Gosha remarks in his History of Vietnam, quote, "Since 1950, Vietnamese communists had already imported Marxism-Leninism and a heavy dose of Maoism to structure the party state in the Marquise." Now, just as an aside, remember that's a phrase that basically means the forest, hills, jungle kind of thing. Structure the party state in the Marquise, indoctrinate a faithful bureaucracy and a fresh military caste, and transform the society and its economy in the communist mold. They now extended this to all of Vietnam above the 17th parallel. End quote. You may also recall from episode 14, in discussing the climactic end to the First Indochina War at Tien Bien Phu, that the Viet Minh had gone to rather extreme lengths in an attempt to stay in the war, push the French into that massive defeat, as well as try and administer this new country at the same time. As in the rest of the examples of socialist states attempting to undertake this process, similar moves were made. One of the easiest examples to draw upon here, and a way for us to investigate this new nation, is through what is known as the Land Reform Campaign, which lasted from about 1953 to 1957. As early as 1952, after Ho Chi Minh had visited the Soviet Union, the plans for transforming the Vietnam that he and the Politburo had in mind were underway. In a letter that Ho sent to Stalin as he left, the desire to emulate the model that had been set out by the Man of Steel, as well as what was going underway in the People's Republic of China, is easy to see. Quote, "Very much beloved and respected comrade, today I am leaving for my country. I thank you very much for what you have done for me. I promise you to work diligently in the realization of the agrarian program and in waging our patriotic war. I hope I will be able to come back in 2 or 3 years so as to submit to you a report on the results of our work. I wish you very good health and very long life. I embrace you heartily. Din." End quote. Just to note there, Comrade Din was how Ho Chi Minh was known to the Soviet leaders at this time. Now, what we're going to discuss in the land reform campaign, we've seen this before a few times, and it's why to some extent I included those previous examples in episodes exploring other revolutions. But here we can explain the aims of the Vietnamese communists in this instance of state policy along these lines, and I'll paraphrase Gosha here. So first, and this was more relevant as they were actually fighting the French, they wanted to mobilize the majority of the population under their control, i.e. the peasantry, for war-making reasons, supplies, troops, labor. Secondly, they wanted to enmesh themselves into the power structure of the population, legitimizing themselves as the heads of state and society and anchoring their bureaucratic control over people and territory. The third aim here was destroying the old system, the so-called feudal and bourgeois classes and power structures that were blocking communist transformation of society. And the final result of all of this would be to prepare the road ahead for eventual full-scale collectivization of agriculture, which would in turn lead to the industrialization of the economy, and that's the Soviet PRC model in this Vietnamese context, isn't it? Alongside of these land reform aims was also a policy designed to reorganize the party membership as well, to purify it to an extent, and rid itself of those exploiting classes that had counted themselves part of the movement in a prominent way leading up to this point. But what do we mean by land reform here? Well, essentially the aim was to redistribute land from landlords, so-called rich peasants, and even from middle peasants, to the poor peasants, as were the categories outlined by the party itself. The Politburo, headed by Ho Chi Minh, but alongside other prominent members, would come to a decision, and then they would decree the method by which that decision is going to be implemented. In this instance, the May 4th directive from the Vietnam Workers' Party regarding land reform is a handy source for us to see how this is communicated to lower rungs of cadre and then enforced. I'll quote from it at length here, as it's kind of illuminating. Quote, "The previously issued directive of the Central Committee on Mass Mobilization has explained clearly our mass mobilization policy. This directive discusses tactical directions for the campaign that you comrades can rely on while carrying out the policy of the party and the government." Now it has a subheading, which is "The Punishment of Reactionary and Evil Landlords." I must stop it there for a second. That's an interesting turn of phrase, isn't it? We've got the reactionary part, which is functional communist language for, as we've said before, a kind of heretical person, anyone that is against the ideology of the party. And that's followed up with the word evil landlords, which doesn't leave much in the way of nuance. Anyway, let's continue. Quote, "In this campaign, we must execute a number of reactionary or evil landlords. In our current situation, the number of executions is fixed in principle at the ratio of 1 per 1,000 people of the total population in the free areas." I'll just have an aside here. Remember, this is when they're still fighting the war against the French. Okay, going on. "This ratio will be controlled by the leadership and applied to the rent and interest reduction campaign this year and next year. But this does not mean that the ratio will apply only to this year. Nor does it mean that every village will execute landlords according to this ratio. Thus, there may be communes that execute 3 or 4 people, and others that execute only 1 or none at all. Human lives are an important matter. It is not that we do not want to execute those who deserve execution, but the number of executions should not be too many. If so, it would make it difficult for the people to agree with us." End quote. Now, the directive goes on to outline some practical ways for cadre to decide who and who not to execute, as well as the bureaucratic mechanisms involved. But there are a few things that this document highlights. First is the explicit willingness, again, coming from the Politburo itself, to use executions in order to carry out this land reform policy. The section which describes the nuance about killings and public image is interesting too. It's not that we don't want to execute lots of people that deserve it, but we must be careful not to go overboard, or else the public might turn on us. It's an interesting example of government speak. But in any case, this directive serves as a connection between leadership, policy, and of course, results. And what did this look like in practice? Well, one of the most handy sources I have here is from a compilation of primary documents collected by Edward Miller on the Vietnam War. And this one in particular gives us a very detailed view from a Vietnamese communist cadre who remembered this period of land reform and the party purges. He was a musician and part of a propaganda unit. He had travelled the country during the war and was now part of the thousands who had regrouped in the north. I'll quote him at length here and jump in to make a few points, but this is Han V's recollection on how this land reform happened. Quote, "I was there when the land reform movement started. Like everyone else, I had to analyse the way my thinking had developed, especially how my class background had influenced it. It turned out that my services over the past 8 years weren't enough. First of all, my family was held against me. My father was a traditional doctor who also owned a kind of pharmacy for Chinese medicines. So I was from the merchant class. Before, no one knew who came from what class, but now we had to be organized by background before we could take another step. None of us were happy about it, but what could you do?" Now, skipping ahead a paragraph or two, Han V speaks about his experience living in a village he had been assigned to whilst the land reform itself was being undertaken. Quote, "To do this, the party sent in a team of land reform cadre. They had a system for putting a village through land reform, a series of steps. The first step started with the land reform cadre moving into the cottages of the very poorest peasants. They made friends with these people, and then they set up meetings with other poor people. At the meetings, they'd have people tell their stories, talk about how badly they lived. They'd get them worked up and excited about how poor they were, and they'd explain to them about why they were so poor. They molded these people, the bottom proletariat, into the driving force in the land reform. They turned them into the strongest element in the village." End quote. All right, next he goes on to describe how the people in the village were classified, basically on how much land or money they had. So a landlord was anyone who didn't work for themselves, but hired someone to work for them. Anyone who owned more than the average share of land was a landlord. Rich peasants, the category down from the landlords, were those who worked the land, but also hired people to work for them occasionally. Middle peasants were those who rented land and had their own means to farm it, like an ox or some extra farming tools. There was a slight differentiation in this category of middle peasant as well. If you were producing enough to survive, plus a little more, you were an upper middle peasant, and then a lower middle peasant produced just enough to survive, or just below that. So they were always in debt. Poor peasants, the lowest category, was a life of poverty. You were in debt to the degree that your children would be forced to work to pay off your debts, and it wasn't unusual that you may need to even sell your children or give them to a landlord. All right, now, continuing with Han V, who's going to describe what happens after this classification step. Quote, "Once the classification was done, the land reform cadres formally took over the village administration." I'll just add here as well that this could mean usurping the already present communist cadre who administered the village. Anyway, he goes on. "The whole right to govern was in the hands of the land reform team. Then they were ready for the last step, the denunciations. When they were ready, they gathered all the poor and lower middle peasants together in a mass outdoor meeting. The rest of the village, the upper middle and rich, were confined to their homes. The land reform cadre stood behind a table and told the people about the government's policy of punishment and land redistribution. Then some of the people began coming up to the front, the ones who had the worst stories. As they told them, people were crying and getting really worked up. Some of them were shouting, 'Down with the landlords!' Then the cadres would bring in the richest landlord. He was standing at the front with his head down. People walked up to him, accusing him and screaming at him. They forced him to admit every crime. Some woman accused him of rape, and he said, 'No, he didn't rape her.' And the crowd exploded in anger. Everyone did. Even his relatives had to parade up to denounce him. When all the denouncing was over, the cadres evaluated who were the worst landlords, and they sentenced them to death. They had a quota they had to fill. Even some party members suffered, people who were revolutionaries, but who came from the upper classes. All the peasants were happy with the land reform, at least at first, when land was distributed to them. Later, when they were forced into collectives, they weren't happy at all." End quote. So what we have here is rather like what we discussed in the Mao episode, in the period before total collectivization and the Great Leap Forward. In Vietnam, in this instance, we have these roaming land reform cadre with their list of members of the village, and they're looking to kind of invert the social hierarchy in a way that empowers the peasants, and they're also looking to install a regime-friendly administration into the villages, thus cementing their control over the state and the countryside. The land and resources from the top two classifications of the village was redistributed to the lower three. Those in charge of this were imbued with extraordinary legal powers to enact the policy, including capital punishment. And the struggle sessions, wherein people were encouraged to denounce those accused, well, as you can imagine, they frequently became violent. Now, if the intention, if the aim of the party was to redistribute the land and to destroy the old feudal class, as they would have put it, well, they did so. More than 2 million acres of land was redistributed in this fashion in the 4 or so years the campaign lasted. But as Ben Kiernan states, quote, "The result had come with a high level of violence." And as Gosha adds, "This social revolution also wreaked social economic havoc and indescribable psychological pain." Gosha recounts the story of Nguyen Thi Nam, one of many so-called evil landlords, who had duly paid their taxes, donated land, reduced their rents, supported the war for independence, and sent fathers, sons, and daughters to the front for the Viet Minh. She was born into a small family, went into business to make ends meet, and through her hard work was able to become a successful merchant. She donated large amounts of money to Ho Chi Minh's government, and during the war, urged her sons to join the war against the French, which they did. She was a capitalist, sure, but her support for the movement earned her the name Resistance Mother in the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. That all changed during this transformative period, however. She became part of the enemy class. Her patriotism was not enough. To make an example of her, the land reform cadres put her before hundreds of poor peasants and led them into a hate-filled demonstration against her, jeering, spitting, and slapping her. She was then executed in July of 1953. As Han V said, these cadres had their quotas to fill. Many were executed. There is no official number. However, Kiernan says somewhere between 3,000 but possibly higher than 15,000 may have been killed, while Gosha simply states that the most reliable estimates are in the 5,000 to 15,000 people range. And psychologically too, we should speak about that, because for the people that weren't killed, the impact was severe. And you know, we're not talking about billionaires here. Gosha also shares the story of a man who recalled this happening when he was just a boy. His family, despite never really having enough food, fell into this bad class category, and his mother was labelled a village tyrant, and being forbade to have any contact with relatives and neighbours in the village, they were forced to subsist on mouldy dried cassava root or banana root porridge for years. Again, to quote Gosha, the Vietnamese Workers' Party dispatched tens of thousands of cadres to organise 5 successive waves of hate and fear that surged through villages, homes, and lives. The Communist Party encouraged children to spy on their parents, neighbours to denounce each other, and required local village officials to follow orders or face severe sanction. End quote. It almost seems bizarre to say, but when we talk about this campaign and its results, and I'll talk a little bit more about the leadership as well in a moment, but these numbers, and we'll take some middle amount between those estimates, so we'll say around 10,000 executions. That is a lot, isn't it? But when we compare this to other regimes who the Vietnamese Workers' Party were emulating, it isn't as quote-unquote bad. I realise there is a significant population difference, but when comparing with, say, the People's Republic of China in this same period, we are talking about basically an order of magnitude less in terms of state-sponsored killings in pursuit of ideological or political motivations. That being said, this is rather shocking, I mean, particularly when we see it laid out within that directive that I quoted earlier. They put a percentage on it. Said, hey, we will execute X amount of people. And it's hard to think of an example of this that you or I, predominantly listening from Western democratic countries, can relate to. But perhaps something along the lines of, I don't know, replace evil landlord with some version of immigration status in the classification that the cadre were performing village to village. Just imagine a group of people come to town and fairly arbitrarily designate you a classification based upon, I don't know, were your parents born here, or were your grandparents, great-grandparents? Someone might be a fully functioning and productive member of that town, but then one day they are told that actually, no, you are part of the problem, a problem that we are going to fix. They spend weeks speaking to all of the people in town who could say they've lived in the town for generations, convincing them that anyone who couldn't do so was terrible and the root of all of the town's problems. And before you know it, you have been completely cast out. Or worse, you are being pilloried in an organized fashion, if not executed publicly, to a round of vitriolic applause. And as I alluded to earlier, this is not only being aimed at the population and society, but also party membership as well. These class designations could apply to someone like Han V, who was a committed revolutionary, but due to his parents owning a small shop, you were looked at as a class enemy. It's interesting as I write this and scan ahead slightly in the story. This may be in fact one of the last times we discuss an example of this kind of societal upheaval along communist lines, before we speak about the Khmer Rouge doing so. Naturally, we will be spending many more hours on that in the future, but it's worth pointing out the models that are in place that they too will be emulating, which essentially boils down to class being the determining factor in whether someone is suitable to be a member of society, or in this case, how their former role in the former society dictates their position, if any, in the new one. The difference being, as I've said at least one or two times in previous episodes, is simply the scope and speed and ruthlessness that characterizes the Khmer Rouge's plan to transform society. Now, within genocide studies, there is a generally recurring theme of this binary. You see it in many cases, either someone is part of the good race or the bad race, the good religion or the bad religion, a revolutionary or a counter-revolutionary. But what the Vietnamese Workers' Party was doing here is not a genocide. In fact, I will go on to argue that aside from a few specific examples against specific groups, like the Cham Muslims or actually the ethnic Vietnamese, the vast majority of killings that the Khmer Rouge will perpetrate are unable to be classified as genocide according to the UN definition of that crime. There's a video on the YouTube channel already explaining this if you are interested, but without getting too far ahead, again, we see this influence of political energy in producing the kinds of actions that legitimize simply killing people who are not with you. And we see it again on this smaller scale in the land reform campaign in North Vietnam, of those who can inculcate this political energy into the masses to cement their own power, as well as convince them who is worth executing. Now, the land reform campaign, as we've said here, it covers a period between the latter stages of the war against the French into about 1956. You may recall that after the Geneva Accords were agreed upon, and the war ended, and the country was divided at the infamous parallel, there was this period of the 300 days, where movement between the two states was allowed. This introduces an interesting question, one that Alec Holcomb brought up in his book, Mass Mobilization in the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, where he considers why, given the Politburo's obsession with these evil landlords, internal enemies, rightist deviationists, spies, saboteurs, mind you, this is language that will be echoed by the Khmer Rouge, that given that this is seemingly what the regime was so concerned with eradicating for the good of their revolution, why not simply encourage these people to pack up and go to South Vietnam? Well, one of the senior leaders explained this, quote, "We must recognize that the task of wrecking the enemy's scheme of forcing compatriots to go south is a tense and urgent political struggle, mainly for the purpose of angling for the masses to stay in their home regions, in their villages, to participate in the work of building the country and not being forced by the enemy to serve as soldiers or as plantation workers where they would be full of misery and hardship. If the enemy succeeded in their scheme, it would be disadvantageous for us politically. They would be able to fool both world and domestic opinion by claiming that Vietnamese went to the south because our regime is not good, creating disadvantages for us in the upcoming elections." End quote. I'll discuss what happens with these scheduled elections more later in the episode when we discuss the state building of South Vietnam. But it's interesting to note here the calculations involved, both domestically and in terms of political opinion of the regime, in simply letting these people go, as opposed to enforcing this new society upon them. It would look bad if they left. So, rather than letting them go, we will re-educate. We will terrorize them into conformity. But to slightly wrap up this example of the land reform campaign in explaining the state building in the north, we can look to its end, as well as the reaction to it, and the reaction of the leadership, to give us an impression of how this state functioned and how it presented itself. Interestingly, the end of the land reform campaign was influenced by factors within North Vietnam, as well as abroad. To speak of the domestic reaction first, again, we're talking about thousands of arrests, imprisonments, trials, and executions, breaking apart families and communities. Sometimes there was a reaction to this. In early November of 1956, several hundred angry Catholic Vietnamese in Nghệ An province carried out protests against the regime. This was quickly quashed by an entire infantry division, the number of people arrested or killed remaining unknown. But that was not all. North Vietnamese intellectuals were also beginning to question the campaign. In late 1956, a handful of those who disagreed with the nature of the regime and the effects of the land reform started to push for constitutional reform, as did many within what we might call the artistic intellectual community. As Gosha says, quote, "The party's stance in relation to this oscillated between tolerance and even tacit sympathy for its opponents to open hostility and outright repression." End quote. Now, the reason that these voices were appearing and the attitude from the party toward them would shift to either of these sides is because of the party's own admissions that the land reform campaign had not been perfect. Ho Chi Minh himself was receiving thousands of letters from around the country explaining the horrors that had been inflicted. By the middle of 1956, party newspapers began reporting on mistakes in the campaign that needed to be corrected. Ho Chi Minh addressed a letter to the compatriots of the country in which he said that errors have been committed in the implementation of unity in the countryside. The party and the government have taken up seriously the subject of those lacks and errors and have determined a plan for their correction. Vo Nguyen Giap, the famous general of Dien Bien Phu fame, made similar statements in October of the same year, stating that we committed deviations in not emphasizing the necessity for caution and for avoiding the unjust disciplining of innocent people. We attacked on too wide a front and used excessive repressive measures on a wide scale. Both Ho and Giap also stated that any mistakes made in classifying individuals into incorrect categories would try to be rectified. But as Ho also admitted, the party could not bring the dead back to life. This move was actually called by the party the Rectification of Errors campaign, and leaders and cadre were compelled to publicly confess their sins. As Gosha points out, quote, "This public and highly ritualized act of ideological contrition served to clean the slate, ensure that all had the new right thinking, and to reassert the legitimacy of communist rule going forward." But he goes on to say, quote, "This mise-en-scene fooled none of those who had suffered so much in a revolution in which they had so little to say. Even those who benefited from finally obtaining a plot of land would have to give it up in a few short years' time when the party sought to take it back, as in China and the Soviet Union. What the collectivization of the countryside required trumped any other considerations." End quote. What you generally see and hear about this period when it does come up is that it was bad, sure, but not as bad as in other similar attempts at reform, like the aforementioned Soviet Union or People's Republic of China, or indeed Democratic Kampuchea under the Khmer Rouge. But what does perhaps provide a point of difference is the public ownership of the failures on behalf of the leadership, Ho Chi Minh included. And that's a fair enough statement, and one I'm not too concerned with undermining. But it should also be pointed out that the context in which this apologetic and mistake-owning sentiment is being said. If you cast your mind back to the episode we did on Maoism, you may recall the importance of the new Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, and his so-called secret speech. This denunciation of the crimes of Stalin and the cult of personality that he had maintained. That was in 1956. At the height of the North Vietnamese land reform campaign. The year after, in another example of this, in the People's Republic of China, the Hundred Flowers campaign occurred, where questioning of the regime was encouraged and, well, subsequently punished, as we saw. But this was also around protests in other Soviet countries like Poland and Hungary, which were being severely repressed. I believe the way I explained these events in that episode about China in terms of countries in this kind of Soviet sphere, was that there was an acknowledgement that some steam needed to be let out of a system in which repression of most of the population was the status quo. But letting the people let off some steam is not the same as giving them freedom to choose a different regime. And just as quickly as that steam valve might be let open, it can be very forcefully shut. I only bring this up to bring a slightly cynical take to the idea that, oh well, sure the North Vietnamese made mistakes, but at least they apologized. Which, you know, in and of itself is probably the least they could have done. But it had political motivations as well, that were tied to domestic and international influence. Particularly for someone like Ho Chi Minh, whose personality cult was impressive, it still is, that when Khrushchev is out there saying that this is a dangerous thing to have, well, Ho needs to be quite careful given the distaste many had to this land reform campaign debacle. The party is able to do so by accepting some responsibility for the excesses of the campaign, but split the difference here by claiming that most mistakes were made by lower level cadre who had failed to understand their instructions, or through the stepping down of one of the senior leaders in a kind of I'll take the bullet on this one kind of arrangement. Truong Chinh is the leader who does so, keeping Ho Chi Minh's legacy and cult of personality safe, and in doing so, this actually opens up a position for the future leader of the party, a southerner named Lê Duẩn, to assume a high-ranking post. So the leadership are able to navigate the backlash to their reforms, and by 1960 are able to introduce a new constitution. This constitution enshrines the power of the Communist Party, ensuring its supremacy over the national political system, and would guarantee that communism was the official ideology of the state, economy, and society. And before we get on to South Vietnam and their project of consolidating that state, I feel that aside from going over the land reform campaign and its aftermath, as I'm basically talking about a new country and how this country is operating, I want to give a slightly more general example of what, you know, what North Vietnam was. As basically, from 1960 onward, the upcoming war with the South and the US will more or less be the bulk of our discussion in future episodes. Basically, the North was a repressive place to live. Educated writers or dissidents could face expulsion from their profession, perhaps need to shore up their ideological stance through periods of enforced hard labour, and if you were a dissenter, it was best to speak in very uncertain terms about what you thought. Particularly if you lacked connection to the Vietnamese Workers' Party. Ben Kiernan includes an example of a 22-year-old teacher in Hanoi around December 1960. Kiernan explains that this teacher was taking a class on behalf of a friend who had become ill, and noticed how in the history textbook that he was using to teach the class, it stated that the Soviet Union had defeated Japan in Manchuria, thus ending the Second World War. Kiernan quotes him as saying to his students, "Oh no, the United States defeated Japan when they dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki." Police arrested him soon afterwards, and the young teacher was sentenced, without trial, to hard labour for 3.5 years. When CIA-sponsored commando teams, comprised of South Vietnamese, began being captured in the North in 1961, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam heightened its search for so-called counter-revolutionaries and set up concentration camps in which this educational reform of suspects was to be undertaken. Turning our attention to South Vietnam, around the same period of time, sort of post-Geneva into the early 60s, we're basically looking at a similar state-building project, but with different benefactors and a different ideology. Ngô Đình Diệm, the chosen ruler of this new state, is a very interesting character in this story. I've recommended this in an early episode, but Sam Davis, who makes the Inward Empire podcast, did a great series on Ziem, and I feel we have a similar vision for what this kind of content can be, so feel free to check out that for a great deep dive into the president of South Vietnam. But essentially, Ziem is a French-educated Catholic, obsessed with modern sovereignty and nationalism and state building. He reminds me just a little of Son Ngoc Thanh on the Cambodian side of the story. Like if Sihanouk had been forced to stand down at the end of the French War and they were looking around for an exiled, educated politician to take the lead, they would have gone and got Thanh. Ziem feels like that to me, but only circumstantially, quite different characters. In practice, the Ziem regime will be plagued by authoritarianism, repression, nepotism, and general heavy-handedness. He will be portrayed as a puppet of the imperialists, but aside from giving him his strings, the US could only wish they had more control over the actions of the South Vietnamese leader. What this kind of boils down to is the idea that Ziem had, as he himself explained to a CIA interlocutor, was that, quote, to rule, it was enough to have an army and an administrative apparatus, end quote. Just as in the North, and hey, so too in Cambodia, all of these, what could we say, post-colonial French governments, whether communist or not, sought to concentrate the power of the state into a monopoly of a very select few, or at least one single group. The Vietnamese Workers' Party enshrined the 1960 North Vietnam Constitution with the unalterable power of the Communist Party. We saw a series of constitutional amendments made by Sihanouk to ensure that he was the head of state, and in South Vietnam, Ziem's 1955 constitution provided extraordinary powers to an executive branch of the government, which essentially made it so he was ruling by presidential decree. He had control over the military, foreign policy, and enjoyed an array of emergency powers. As Gosha says, quote, in practice, the Ngo brothers had little more respect for the people than the communists they so despised, end quote. The Geneva Accords had outlined the process that these two areas were to be divided, but also undivided. I remember saying when we touched on that process in that episode, in episode 14, that they were never actually supposed to create two different states, but in practice that's exactly what happened. And from the outset, the Geneva Accords were undermined in a variety of ways. I mean, the US were biding their time at the negotiations, half threatening direct military intervention and half waiting on getting the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization set up. They were, you know, there for the accords being signed, but not signatories of the document. They had an out, basically. Likewise, Ziem, once installed in power, he could basically say, oh, well, it wasn't my government that was at the negotiating table. We aren't going to participate in these elections, and if they're supposed to take place in 1956, stuff it. He also refused to talk with the North about holding them when that date approached. So the elections that were called for just simply don't happen. It's important to note as well that Ziem's benefactors in the United States had predicted that the communists would easily win a free election if it were held in the North or the South. But at the end of the day, the Vietnamese from both new countries, well, they would be denied the choice of their rulers. Unfortunately, somewhat of a recurring theme in US foreign policy at this time was the disavowing of actual democratic values that they were aspiring to bring to the world. As long as their guy was staunchly committed to anti-communism, it's fair to say that without their support for Ziem, that he wouldn't have been able to consolidate power in the South and attempt to build a state that would be the means of stopping those dominoes from falling. So in Ziem, their guy, he was fiercely nationalistic, yes, but was completely unwilling to compromise or enter into coalitions with other groups. It was basically his way or the highway, and he appointed his family members to important, powerful positions, which even from an early point would begin to annoy senior members of, say, the military. As early as 1955, so, you know, a year into this project, the CIA were worrying that there was an enormous gap between the government and the people, that what they had unwittingly created was an emerging fascist state. And, well, if your overall goal is to financially and militarily support this state, as long as it stops communism spreading, well, Ziem's early moves were at least fitting that description. Although perhaps that will be a double-edged sword, as we will see. First things first, however, in the aftermath of Geneva, Ziem actually sets out to crush his non-communist rivals, sometimes through force. Once this was complete, he would now be able to deploy the newly renamed Army of the Republic of Vietnam, ARVN, against the southern communists that still remained. In early 1955, Ziem, through decree, announced the anti-communist denunciation campaign. In an almost, you know, mirrored image of some of the policies enacted in the north, this campaign sought to weed out any communist opposition to the regime, and security personnel and officials were told to classify the population, not in terms of their class background, as it was in the north, but rather their family background, political affiliations, and their general attitudes toward communism and the government of South Vietnam. Kind of like an inverse of what happened in the north, right? As Gosha explains, quote, "For those who posed little threat, the government organized village ceremonies and community self-criticism sessions. Re-education centers dealt with tougher cases. In carefully choreographed rituals, former communist supporters would ask for forgiveness from fellow villagers and local authorities before swearing allegiance to the Republican flag and its great leader, Ngo Dinh Ziem." End quote. The year after, the regime went even further. A presidential ordinance authorized the arrest and imprisonment of anyone deemed to be a threat to national security. Concentration camps were used as thousands of people were caught in this net, many of whom weren't even communists. A further amendment to state legislation allowed for special tribunals with the power to arrest, imprison, and execute those accused of, as Gosha says, vaguely defined revolutionary activities. This policy, as ham-fisted as it may have been, did have an effect on the activities of southern communists. Below the 17th parallel, membership in the Vietnamese Worker Party fell from 50,000 in 1954 to 15,000 in 1956, and by 1959, there were only 5,000 left. The effect this had on the southern members led to an increased lobbying with the north to allow for retaliation. The move from political struggle to armed struggle, of which we will speak more of in just a moment. Ziem's regime also went about its own land reform campaign, again borrowing from the north. They had seen how this process had been effective during the First Indochina War at extending state control over people and territory. However, if we can call the north's campaign a quote-unquote success in its stated aim of redistributing land, even if it cost thousands of lives, the land reform campaign in the south was, comparatively, a failure. First, it occurred unevenly. In some places, no land exchanged hands at all. And second, only one third of land under control of these large land-owning groups was successfully redistributed across the country. Ziem wasn't able to utilize the kind of force that had occurred in the north for risk of inviting a coup against his rule, and he did not have the kind of bureaucratic mechanisms available to enforce it as they had in the north. Eventually, they would backtrack on the project, leaving many unsatisfied with the attempt. Now, this was occurring in the same years that the regime was attempting to resettle the almost 800,000 refugees that had travelled south in the so-called 300 days period. Most were Catholic, the group that Ziem was most liable to be seen as favouring, as a member of this minority group himself. Resettling these people would often be done in a way that would affect highland minorities or at least in places where the residents would resent new groups being moved into their territory. It's always worth remembering that there are a diverse range of ethnic groups and long-standing tensions between different areas and peoples in Vietnam. It is not an ethnic monolith, as we explored in some of the earliest episodes of this series. All in all, what I'm basically trying to get across here is that the state building that Diem's regime was attempting to do was characterized by many of the same human rights abuses that were being committed by the hated communists in the north. And behind the president was not some diverse coalition of leaders that represented different groups and polities around the country, but simply the family of the president. A southern Vietnamese historian, active in the late 1950s, traveling the country and researching different historical monuments, noted what he saw. Quote, "A great deal of cynicism toward the regime spread among the common people. Those born and raised in the South complained about discrimination and about the regime's favoritism to mostly Catholic northern refugees, that it was a sinister path they were pursuing, with more and more restrictions on basic human rights. Toward a dictatorship, totalitarianism, one party and one family rule, because the Ngo family and their in-laws occupied almost all the key positions." End quote. We will continue to explore the events that occur in South Vietnam leading up into, say, 1963, as the population becomes less and less enamored with the Diem regime, and as I said, all these crises start to occur. But at the moment, within this three-part exploration into the path to the Vietnam War, as we might call it that, or the Second Indochina War, we're necessarily attempting to explain the various moving pieces that will click together and produce that devastating conflict. And then we will move on to how that machinery spills into Cambodia and into the rise and fall of the Khmer Rouge. So far we've looked into the two states that have established themselves in the wake of the war with the French, a very general overview, I should hasten to say. But a crucial piece of the machinery that will add to the upcoming war is the rise of a new front to take up a struggle against the South Vietnamese state. And we do need to explain that, because if you recall in the Geneva Agreements, there was a stipulation that the remaining Viet Minh in the South would consolidate their forces back in the North. But as we've seen, a major policy initiative of the Diem regime was eradicating the remaining communist elements in the South. They were going to be either captured or killed. So when we begin talking about the early stages of the Vietnam War, it is the South, communists within the South, that will be essentially staging an uprising against the Diem regime. Now, who is that going to be? Now, as Edward Miller suggests, quote, "In the long run, the Diem government's harsh anti-communist policies would prove counterproductive. Because government officials had sweeping powers to accuse and detain almost anyone without due process, the crackdown greatly exacerbated the fear and resentment that many rural residents felt toward the Saigon regime. Communist Party cadres would eventually turn these feelings to their advantage." End quote. By 1958, the southern communists were in a dire position. As I mentioned, their numbers had been decimated. But the Vietnamese Worker Party Politburo, what we can simply just begin saying the North, was equivocating on the best course of action. They knew that their benefactors, you know, the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China, they're not champing at the bit to head straight back into another Indochinese war. They also worried that establishing an organization in the South that directly engaged in the resumption of war, well, that might prompt direct American military intervention. The turning point came in 1959. Lê Duẩn, the southern VWP member who was making strides toward becoming the leader of the party, well, he had been lobbying for the creation of a new national front that would adopt violent struggle, and that simply consolidating power in the North would not achieve the true revolutionary aims that would really require the entire country to be under the control of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Southern militants had already begun to undertake limited, although violent, measures against the Diem regime. In 1958, for instance, they were killing Diem's paramilitary forces at a rate of about 40 men per week, as well as initiating targeted attacks on various military personnel, village chiefs, officials, and private citizens. Even before they could count on the explicit support of the North, the South had begun to strike back against Diem. But by 1959, the Politburo made the choice to build a new national front, protect it with force, and provide the weapons and personnel to achieve its aims of eventually overthrowing the Diem regime. In May of that year, they began resurrecting and extending the complicated network of paths and roads from the north into Laos, then through Cambodia, and into the south of Vietnam. The Ho Chi Minh Trail was back. This symbol of the First Indochina War would once again become a symbol of the Second, and with its increased use, so too did the North begin devising a plan for overthrowing Diem and installing a regime that would reunify with the North. Lê Duẩn, the southern cadre, who had climbed the ranks and who Ho Chi Minh had kind of taken under his wing, well, he was elected as leader of the Vietnamese Workers' Party in 1960. He had been instrumental in lobbying for the resumption of armed struggle in the South, and now he would be in charge in the North to realise that aim. In December of that same year, the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam, or the NLF, or the Viet Cong, as they became known in the West, was brought to life. Thousands of those communist southerners who had returned to the North following the Geneva Accords were smuggled back into the South as they looked to build a formidable organization. But this was not the same as the North simply sending their army into the South and declaring war. No, that would bring the US straight into the picture. Rather, as Gosha states, quote, "The communists in Hanoi would rather expand their political sovereignty and military control indirectly by supporting efforts already underway to form a national front and by providing a southern armed force to protect it." End quote. The administrators and specialists returning to the South were able to quickly turn the NLF into an alternative political sovereignty to the Diem regime. They established bases in the villages, intensified anti-Diem propaganda, began organizing women, children, and youth and peasants into patriotic associations. They initiated land reform when they could, and even set up a system of taxation. Armed and dangerous, but more importantly, functioning as a state within a state, the civil war which had engulfed Vietnam for decades had now resumed. By 1961, Diem's regime would estimate that it had lost control of more than half of its population. This is why the Cambodian communists had evolved their own organization in 1960 in that train car conference that we discussed previously. The gears were beginning to turn, and the NLF was a formidable force in next to no time. The question now was what the Americans would do in order to protect the regime they had set up to stop the communists from taking control of all of Vietnam. How far would they go to stop the dominoes falling? By the 1950s, the US had extended its doctrine of containment to all of Southeast Asia, the inevitable result being that the division of Vietnam, and subsequently the future of Cambodia and Laos, became the linchpin of the globalized Cold War. East and West would confront on this beautiful part of the planet where regional nationalism and communism would fuel a long and devastating conflict. In the next part of these shorter, more focused examinations of that coming war, we're going to look at the US role more broadly, as well as the evolving situation in Laos, and the crises that envelop South Vietnam and lead to such horrific protests like Quang Duc's self-immolation that we introduced this episode with. Until next time, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back soon. Goodbye.